From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The President's Trip to Asia, Substance and Symbols. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. As the U.S. continues to struggle out of a recession, Asia currently is regarded as the most economically dynamic place in the world. In high-profile visits to four countries in 8 days, President Obama will express what the State Department calls strategic reassurance. We'll hear what that means to allies, including Japan and South Korea, and to China, which the president calls a competitor and a vital partner. We'll hear about conflicts with different countries and broader issues of human rights, global warming, Iran, and Afghanistan. On Reporter's Notebook, humans, chimpanzees, and the gene for speech. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. As President Obama visits Asia, the U.S. is still in deep trouble while China is riding high economically. What does America want, and what can it provide in the newest world order? On Reporter's Notebook, genetic comparisons between humans and chimpanzees shows why we can speak and they can't. First, this news update. President Obama is considering four options for Afghanistan, all involving sending more troops. Now the ambassador to Kabul, Carl Eikenberry, says don't send any reinforcements at all until the Karzai regime cracks down on corruption. Peter Spiegel is reporting the story for The Wall Street Journal. And Peter, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
This is apparently contained in two classified cables, which I gather have been leaked. Do we know how they got out?
Well, fortunately, I can't reveal sources, but these were sent to Washington within the last week or so. So literally in the run-up to the meeting yesterday at the White House that discussed the way ahead on these four options that you mentioned. And, you know, again, these concerns about Karzai aren't new necessarily. Other members of the administration have expressed similar concerns. But Eikenberry comes with a whole different set of baggage. I mean, first of all, he's a retired lieutenant general who was a former commander in Afghanistan up until 2007. So he knows the situation on the ground militarily. At the same time, he has a very long and rather bristly career with Karzai, a relationship with him that dates back to even earlier in his military career. The two of them just don't get along too well. And there is some of that baggage as well. So his opinions are going to carry a lot of weight because of some of his experience. At the same time, it does reflect some of the views that are already being expressed by people in those meetings.
I don't want to spend too long on this. You mentioned that you can't reveal your own sources. I wouldn't ask you to do that. Others have reported the same thing. So clearly, there was an intent on the part of somebody to get the word out. I just wanted to make that point. And obviously, there is division within the White House, within the Obama administration, about what to do.
No, absolutely. And as you know, I mean, the motivations of people to leak information like that to the media are varied and nuanced. And sometimes, frankly, even as reporters, we don't know the motivations.
Sure.
But clearly, this issue of Karzai and corruption has been one that is really weighing very heavily in the president's mind. He has said it publicly. Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, gave a very major speech earlier this week or end of last week in which he said, look, we are not going to send more British boys to get killed for a corrupt government. So this is really weighing very heavily on both the U.S. and its allies. And we've seen some behavior by Karzai of late that raises some questions. He's been on TV giving some interviews where he really belittled the U.S. effort and said some kind things about the U.N.'s effort. So there's a little concern about whether he's on the right page on this one.
Blamed the international community for corruption in his own country.
Exactly.
Do the ambassador's memos constitute a fifth option for the president?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Because the other four options that are currently on the table, the one that has lowest troop increases, was about 10 to 15,000, really is a status quo option. There's several European countries that are threatening to pull out their troops over the next year, the Dutch in particular. The Canadians, another NATO member, are thinking about pulling their troops out. We could be losing, you know, upwards of 5,000 troops from NATO allies. So adding another 10 to 15,000 on the low end is basically just a status quo option. So I don't think we're going to see a freeze on all troop levels that has been recommended, for instance, by Senator Kerry and some others. I think we're really going to see a an increase. It's just a matter of is it 10 to 15,000 or is it the 40,000 that McChrystal asked for?
And there is no indication at the moment that the president is considering declaring victory and leaving.
No, and they've been very clear about that. They said, look, this issue of us pulling out is a red herring. They are not going to pull out. The question is, under what circumstances will they be adding the new troops? And you know, the meeting on Wednesday, the president apparently was very pointed with all the members of his national security team, saying, look, you presented me with these four options, but I still have unanswered questions. I have unanswered questions about when you think the Afghan government can actually take over from us. I have unanswered questions about the cost. So he's gone back and he said, look, thank you for these four options, but I want more information. So these four options are likely to be fleshed out even further as the next week plays out.
Doesn't he also want to know more about an exit strategy and when we might be able to pull out?
Well, that's the main thing. I mean, I think the White House, you know, refrains from calling it an exit strategy, but they talk about when can we expect a handoff? When can the Afghan National Forces, security forces, take over the security responsibilities? When do we expect the Afghan government to step in and do the kind of governance things we're expecting it to do? And he actually basically went back to all the people gathered and said, I want more data on this before I make my decision.
In the meantime, is Ambassador Eikenberry or anybody else being specific about reforms they want to see from Karzai?
There are some. The White House has been a bit sort of holding their cards close to their vests on this. One of the things I've heard from is that specifically they're pestering him about is, look, in order to win re-election, you sort of allied yourselves with a lot of unsavory characters. Rashid Dostum, who's a Uzbek general and a bit of a warlord from the north, was brought back to Kabul and endorsed him. Fahim, who's a former defense minister and was sort of kicked out of the government 5 years ago because of accusations of human rights abuses, he's now a vice presidential candidate. The concern is, rather than bringing sort of capable technocrats to run the various cabinet agencies and government positions, they will be doled out to cronies. And that's one of the things they're looking at to try to ensure that Karzai is really going to implement, you know, get rid of this corruptness.
All right, Peter Spiegel, much more to be decided by the White House. Good to have you with us, senior national security correspondent for the Wall Street. In a moment, the president's trip to Asia, substance and symbols, on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. U.S. influence has been on the decline, while China's influence is increasing. So the overarching theme of the president's trip will be that the U.S. is a Pacific nation engaged with Asia in a very comprehensive way. That's what the National Security Council has been telling reporters. Newsweek's Michael Hirsch puts it this way: America no longer has demands to make, only requests. Michael Hirsch, also author of At War with Ourselves, Why is America Squandering the Chance to Build a Better World? Good to have you on our program.
Happy to be here.
You say that the U.S., the president, will be presenting a new and humbler U.S. profile in Asia. What do you mean?
Well, it was sort of gingerly laid out by Deputy Secretary of State Jim Steinberg recently. It's called the concept of strategic reassurance. And what that means, or what he meant by it, is basically, I'm okay, you're okay. we'll accept the rise of other nations, particularly China, as long as they don't behave inappropriately in the global system and run roughshod over the rest of us, including the United States. And it really is indicative of this general posture that Obama has taken, which is one of equality. He said the same thing about Japan and about the whole idea of the U.S.-Japanese relationship being equal. And that's different. It's a departure from the past where the U.S. Was in a more dominant position. For example, the Bush administration began by treating China as a so-called strategic competitor, where they didn't want to deal with them one-on-one, and then later adopted the posture of advising China that they needed to be a better stakeholder, was the word, that they used in the international system. So it was sort of high-handed advice, whereas now Obama is going there saying, okay, we're all equals in this together. And by the way, can you continue to buy U.S. Treasuries?
The president has said very specifically that China is a competitor and a vital partner. That's pretty different from the strategic competitor that the Bush administration talked about.
Very different. And the vital partner is really a code word for we and China are in this together. People talk about the G20 nations now. At the heart of that is really the G2, which is the United States and China. They continue to fund our debt, surpassing Japan as the largest buyer of U.S. debt, and we continue to buy their products. And it's very much a relationship, a symbiotic relationship. And that is continuing even in the wake of the crisis. But there's no question that the U.S. has slipped from its position of dominance in terms of the kind of advice we hand out and the attitude we've taken to the rest of the world.
What do America's allies in Asia feel about this? Are they worried about China? Are they happy to see the United States less influential in their part of the world?
No, they're not. I mean, and that's, the great trump card of the United States in Asia, in this part of the world that Obama's going to be traveling around for the next week, is that there has always been a deep mistrust of China and also mistrust of Japan, dating back to World War II, at least. And the United States has been seen as the stabilizer, and then, that was really our role during the entire Cold War period. That has not entirely gone away, and of course, the U.S. remains the dominant military. So I think there is some question here about whether Obama is being perhaps a little too humble, and whether this whole idea of strategic reassurance and equality with the rest of these countries is, in fact, unnerving to some of these countries. I mean, an example is Japan. I mean, Japan has really been in a kind of a junior position to the United States ever since the end of World War II, and frankly, the Japanese have been somewhat happy about it, even though this new prime minister, Yukio Hatoyama, came in promising, to rethink some of this partnership. In fact, if you look at public opinion polls in Japan, most Japanese don't really want that. So it's a very, very tough, delicate line for Obama to walk. He doesn't want us to be seen as high-handed. He really can't afford to be seen as high-handed. But at the same time, there is this continued desire in Asia to see some leadership from the U.S.
Is he a rock star in countries of Asia as he is in Europe?
I think we're going to find out. This is his first trip to Asia as president. It's really the first time he's been there in quite a while. He grew up, of course, as an adolescent in Jakarta when his mother worked for the U.S. Embassy there and married an Indonesian. And so it's a little bit of a homecoming for him in some ways. But in other ways, he's really not, an expert in Asia, and the Asians have not had a lot of direct exposure to him. So we will see. I mean, he had, obviously enormous impact when he went to Europe, very positive reviews. He's doing a town hall meeting in Shanghai with Chinese youth. He's delivering a couple speeches, and the hope is that the Obama effect will be as powerful there as it has been elsewhere.
Michael Hirsch, again, senior editor at Newsweek magazine. We'll come back and continue this conversation with you in a moment. First, let me introduce Nicholas Cheney, who is a deputy director of the Japan Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Nicholas Cheney, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk first about Japan. We just heard that there's a new prime minister there. He's only been there for a couple of months, and part of his campaign had to do with kind of separating from the United States, did it not?
Indeed. I mean, no question that election was about the Japanese economy and the need to revive Japan's economic might, but when his party talked about the U.S.-Japan relationship, they introduced some new rhetoric, which sort of signaled perhaps a different approach. One catchphrase still used by the prime minister is the notion of a close but equal alliance, mentioned by Mr. Hirsch earlier, and the question really at this point is what equal alliance means. If it means Japan being more proactive and coming to the U.S. with new ideas about how the two countries can work together on regional and global issues, that will be very productive. In the first 2 months of the Hatoyama administration, however, equal can really, in my view, only be defined as the government articulating grievances, things that they don't like on the U.S.-Japan alliance. The number one issue being the agreement the two governments reached in 2006 to realign U.S. forces in Japan, specifically on Okinawa. So this bilateral summit comes at a very interesting time because the new Hatoyama government has been all about change and approaching the U.S. with a different attitude. At the same time, the president is visiting the region, trying to stress the importance of traditional alliance relationships with countries like Japan. And it'll be really interesting to see whether the two of them can come up with a coherent message during their meetings tomorrow.
The grievances about the American forces on Okinawa go way back historically, and they brought out 20,000 people or so in protest very recently.
Yes, I think the new government really has a challenge here. Hatoyama campaigned with a pledge to renegotiate this agreement from 2006. And since taking office, there's been an open debate among his cabinet members about what the right solution for this Okinawa agreement may be. The Okinawan people would very much like U.S. bases to be gone altogether. A recent poll by one of the Japanese newspapers showed that 70% of Okinawans would really like the U.S. out of Okinawa and not have the government pursue, you know, minor changes to the agreement that would leave them there. At the same time, other polls surveying the general population show that, you know, perhaps it would be good just to move forward with this agreement or alter it slightly, but not sort of bring the whole discussion to a halt. So the new Hatoyama government has to, you know, satisfy the feelings of the Okinawan people, but at the same time somehow show some progress with the U.S. And at this point, it doesn't look like they're going to solve this anytime soon. The two governments did agree to create a working committee to look at this issue again and perhaps find a solution that might be more palatable to the new government. But even though the prime minister and the president will not make an issue of this, it's going to linger for a while and could create some tension in the alliance.
Very quickly, for those of our audience that don't have long historical memories, what are those 20,000 American troops doing there?
Well, I think Okinawa is very strategic if you consider the threats that the U.S. and Japan confront together. If you think of the lack of transparency in the Chinese military buildup or the situation on the Korean Peninsula, the U.S. forces are defending Japan per the security treaty of 1960, and also working with Japanese forces to ensure peace and stability in the region. And it's very important from that respect, and I think the two governments need to be very careful not to create the impression that there is any split between them. And to really move forward on this because of its strategic importance.
Nicholas Cecchini, Deputy Director of the Japan Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Gary Huffbauer is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, author of several books, most recently Global Warming and the World Trading System. Gary Huffbauer, good to have you on our show.
Thanks very much, and apologies for my slightly hoarse voice.
Okay, apology accepted. Where does he go next?
I think the problem that Obama faces, and I realize there's an Obama effect, you know, probably quite strong, but the Asians really wonder, is the United States going to be at the table when it comes to economics? And by that I mean, are we really going to go forward with new trade agreements with Asia or indeed with anybody else? And that's a big question which at least the leaders are pondering. This is an APEC meeting in Singapore, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group, which way back in the 1990s under President Clinton promised to have free trade by the industrial countries by 2010. Well, guess what? That's kind of 2 months away now. And we're nowhere near free trade. And whether President Obama will, put some new life in that pledge or not, whether he will say some nice things about concluding the U.S.-Korea free trade agreement or not, that's a big thing. Whether he will initiate a Trans-Pacific Partnership dialogue or not, another big question. These are the big economic questions which Asians are wondering about. And as was said earlier by Mr. Hirsch, China is all over the place in terms of trade agreements. And I think most Asians are prepared to say, well, the U.S. is withdrawing, not militarily, but economically from Asia. And it will be up to Obama either to confirm that or really to change opinion quite dramatically.
Jerry Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute. Back to Michael Hirsch with Newsweek magazine. You spoke earlier of Jim Steinberg at the State Department explaining the president's trip. What did he have to say about this? And is the United States, in fact, withdrawing, as Gary Huffbauer says many Asians assume it is?
No, I don't think it is. I mean, I agree with Gary that there is that concern. There is always that concern, and particularly in the wake of this demonstration of American weakness, there is also a sense among many Asians that for 20 years now, the Americans have been giving high-handed advice about opening up their financial markets. Look what happened to Wall Street and the American economy as a result of all of this capital, hot money sluicing around. So there's a sense of, I told you so, and you don't hear it outwardly, but you certainly hear it among the Chinese and the Japanese that have kept their financial markets partially closed. But there is this sense that the Americans, that the Obama administration is testing the waters for a new strategic relationship. One always sees this as the beginning of a relationship. Indeed, what Jim Steinberg, the Deputy Secretary of State, said about strategic reassurance was probably something of a trial balloon. Let's throw that phrase out there and see how people react to it. The initial reaction, I don't think, is very good, which is why you haven't heard it repeated very much. But this is a reflection of this president, and this president is about empathy, about getting into the other fellow's shoes, and seeking greater engagement as an equal. And as I said earlier, that does very well. It goes over very well in most countries, but among Asians there is this lingering sense, well, we've always depended on the U.S. as a leader in this region to keep the peace, and can we continue to do that?
Gary Huffbauer, what about climate change? Will that also come up when he's in Singapore with all of these other countries meeting together?
Well, it will with Singapore and the other countries, but especially with China, because nothing's going to happen on climate change unless U.S. and China agree. And right now, and we've done quite a bit of analysis, as others have, the differences are very large. They are not strident, unlike our relationship with India on this question, where the Indians are kind of in your face on it. But the differences with China are extreme. And I'll just point out one thing. The Chinese, very able Chinese scholars, have said, we can't take any hard commitments until 2023.
Wow.
Well, some scientists tell us by 2023 we'll be underwater. So that seems a little far off. And you know how the legislation is going here. The Senate wants China to step up to the plate.
Okay. Gary Huffbauer again at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. We'll come back, talk with our current guest and others as well on our reporter's notebook a bit later, chimpanzees, human beings, and the genetics of speech. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking about the president's trip to Asia, which he is beginning tonight. We've gotten him from Japan to Singapore and now to China. Dan Sutherland is executive editor of the congressionally funded network Radio Free Asia. It provides news to countries that restrict a free press, and that includes China and Burma and North Korea. He was Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post from 1985 to 1990. Dan Sutherland, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
We know that China wants to talk about trade, wants to talk about climate change, although it doesn't want to make any commitments on climate change. The president has an obligation, does he not, to talk about human rights when he's in China?
Yes, he's going to have to talk about human rights, but he's going to do it mostly quietly, and it's not going to be a big focus of the trip. The big opportunity might be the the town hall meeting in Shanghai that was mentioned earlier, which where he has a chance to talk about universal values, create a bit of a vision. But that's going to be a very challenging performance because if he talks to Chinese students, he's likely to run into some who are very nationalistic.
It is young people that he's going to talk to at that town hall.
That's what they're saying, although they're still negotiating. This is a very dicey kind of thing every time it happens with a visiting leader, and the Chinese are still negotiating over the details, but it looks like young people.
You're with Radio Free Asia once again, broadcasting to countries that restrict the free press. Do you think China will, in fact, broadcast his meeting with those young people in Shanghai or not?
It could be subject to some kind of censorship. I believe this happened to Bush before when he made some statements there, and they actually censored the statements. But we'll just have to wait and see. They'll probably decide on the spot how provocative they think it is and then decide.
And is it Tibet that's the main issue?
It's not just Tibet. It's one thing that Radio Free Asia watches carefully is jailed journalists, and China leads the pack in the world in terms of jailing journalists, particularly cyber journalists recently. There are any number of people locked up just for talking about political issues. So I think Obama quietly will be urging perhaps some easing up on these people. I don't think he's going to do it publicly. As was suggested earlier, he's not going to lecture to people. But Tibet will come up. In fact, the Chinese will probably bring it up to make sure that Obama reaffirms, the standing U.S. policy that Tibet is part of China. And this will probably happen behind closed doors. Tibet is really under a lockdown right now, the People's Armed Police practically occupying the entire territory. And in Xinjiang, the Uyghur area, the phone calls, outside phone calls, and internet are still cut off 4 months after the rioting there last July. So it's not, the Chinese are not in a totally confident position on those issues.
Backing up from China to the meeting in Singapore, the president's going to be in the same room, as we understand it, for the first time on the part of an American president with the current leaders of Myanmar or Burma. What about human rights there, and do you think he will raise those issues?
He's going to raise the issue of Aung San Suu Kyi, the democratic leader in Burma who's been under house arrest for 11 years, urging the Burmese to release her, allow her party to have some participation in a election that's planned for 2010. And the Burmese officials have been dropping hints that they might allow that. But it's very hard to see how they could have a free and fair election in Burma, given the domination of the military there. So Hillary Clinton raised this issue of trying to get a free election, and it's just I can't be optimistic about that.
And back in the case of China, when he's there, North Korea no doubt will come up, of course, in the context of the nuclear program, but in the context of human rights as well. Is there any hope of any sort of opening up or any kind of change in North Korea's attitude on and policies on human rights?
That would be a long shot. I think it's very unlikely. North Korea just can't afford to, ease up the way China might be able to afford to ease up. And China is the key, and China is not going to push North Korea on human rights. They don't want a nuclear North Korea, but they also don't want a collapsing North Korea. If North Korea began to even start to reform the way China has reformed, it could mean a loosening of control. So China's first interest is stability, and they recently came through with something of an aid program for North Korea despite the sanctions in place. And they're deeply into North Korean mines to try to extract minerals. So they're playing kind of a tricky game where they've got to go along with the sanctions to a certain extent, but not destabilize North Korea.
And their big concern there might be an enormous migration of people across the border into China.
And I'm glad you mentioned that. That's a great fear on their part. I mean, you could have millions of North Korean refugees, including some North Koreans with weapons coming over. You could, if it got bad enough, you could have South Korea taking over North Korea and creating a big U.S. ally on China's border.
Dan Sutherland, once again, executive editor of the Radio Free Asia organization funded by the Congress of the United States. Michael Hirsch, let me go back to you, senior editor at Newsweek magazine. The final stop for the president will be in Seoul, South Korea. What are the issues there specifically with South Korea itself and then in terms of South Korea's relations with other countries, particularly North Korea?
Well, again, Obama's not going to have too many deliverables, as it's called in foreign policy lingo, things, agreements to be concluded, whether on free trade or anything, you know, very hopeful to say on North Korea, which is really the preeminent national security threat to the South Koreans. You have a sense that there is just no forward movement at all. Where Kim Jong-il, though he's recovered his health apparently, has not been eager to come to any kind of a deal on his nuclear program. And there's been just no movement at all. I mean, there's been a sense that the U.S. may try to send an envoy, Stephen Bosworth, to North Korea at some point soon, and they may discuss that. But I think this is really cosmetics. This is just the optics of stopping off and getting your picture taken with a key U.S. ally and not really much to in terms of making progress.
Gary Hufbauer, back to you at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. What about the free trade agreement with South Korea?
Well, that's what the South Koreans will be wondering, whether the president will indicate, despite the opposition from the unions in this country, the president is willing to take it up anytime soon, by which I mean 2010. They understand the health bill and all that and how it's linked in with an unpopular trade agreement. But they will be looking for some nuance that opens the door to possibly ratifying this agreement in 2010. Now, if the United States doesn't give that, if the president does not give that opening, the South Koreans, like many else in Asia, will say, well, you know, the U.S. is not at the table. They already have an agreement with the European Union. They will proceed with other agreements in the area and an increasingly close trade relationship with China. So that's the game there, and the nuance in his words will be just all important.
How old is the free trade agreement with South Korea? When was it arrived at? And when we talk about ratification, that involves the Senate, right?
Correct. It involves both houses of Congress, the way we go about ratifying trade agreements. And it's a couple years old. It was negotiated by the Bush administration back in 2008. It was wrapped up. There's still some supposed issues on autos and beef. I think that it really is more the visceral opposition in Michigan and some other states to anything that looks like freer trade with South Korea. And there's also, I think, a more legitimate concern in our agricultural states that South Korea is unduly tight on beef imports. There may be some cosmetic changes that could be done on that, but I think you have to realize that the agreement is pretty well there. And if the president doesn't see a way to kind of see over the horizon to get it in place, that will be it'll be a disappointment to South Korea.
Let me go back to Nicholas Cheney, the director of the Japan chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. We haven't really said much about Japan for a few minutes. What are Japan's principal concerns at this point? We heard earlier that a lot of other countries in Asia don't really trust Japan, given its historical behavior. What are Japan's major concerns beyond what we talked about before, the concerns about Okinawa, the fact that there's a new government there? What are they looking for, do you think, from President Obama?
Well, I think quickly the new government has made a pledge to reach out to the region and demonstrate a Japan that's a more active player in regional diplomacy, and I think that's positive and certainly in U.S. interests. Prime Minister Hatoyama has spoken of a multilateral arrangement, a notion of an East Asian community where Japan and other countries in Asia could come together and work on economic and security issues. I think other concerns of the new government are non-proliferation. I think the people of Japan really warmed to the president's Prague speech back in April on the need to rid the world of nuclear weapons. I think you'll see that theme come up. And also climate change. The new government has set a very ambitious midterm emissions reduction target, 25% below 1990 emission levels by 2020, I believe. And Prime Minister Hatoyama has really expressed an interest in working with the United States to fashion some sort of post-Kyoto framework for global negotiations on that front. So there are security issues on the agenda, which are certainly a concern. But I think on the flip side, broadly speaking, on issues like nonproliferation with North Korea and Iran or climate change, there's a lot of room for the new government to work with the U.S., and I think you'll see that come out of the president's visit there. I think, you know, the president will be giving a speech on Saturday outlining his vision for Asia, where I think all of these themes will come up, and he will reiterate the importance of the U.S.-Japan relationship in tackling all these issues. And I think it gets back to Mr. Hirsch's reference to optics. I think this is the beginning of a process in which the president starts to outline a cooperative framework for the region. He'll visit again next year. Japan hosts the APEC summit in 2010, so this is going to take a while, but he'll have a very positive message.
And very quickly, if we can, we're running short of time. What about Afghanistan?
Well, the new government announced an aid package the other day, $5 billion over approximately 5 years for basically economic aid, but some things such as vocational training. And they chose to suspend or end, actually, a refueling mission in the Indian Ocean, which they've been doing since 2001 in support of coalition operations in Afghanistan. So that's another change from the new government. This aid package is supposed to demonstrate a sustained commitment to the future of Afghanistan. What else Japan chooses to do on the security front in the future is an open question.
And Michael Hirsch, quickly back to you at Newsweek magazine. In Singapore, the president's going to be meeting one-on-one with the president of Russia, Mr. Medvedev. What do you anticipate happening there?
Well, that's yet another thing Obama's going to be asking for, which is Russian help in pressuring the Iranians to move forward on the nuclear talks, which are utterly stalled from what I've heard from my sources. They feel that if Medvedev can go beyond some of the rhetoric recently where he's talked about the possibility of sanctions and really hammer home to Iran that this deal that they want to complete on sending uranium abroad to be enriched is a good thing for Iran, then they can move forward and avoid a confrontation over Iran toward the end of the year.
Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute, any hope of change in China's attitude or position with regard to its evaluation of its currency?
Oh, indeed. This is actually a surprising payoff of the visit because the Chinese leadership has changed its rhetoric slightly, and that's the way they move. They change things slightly, and they are preparing the public for a revaluation, I believe, in 2010. It's a small nuance, but it is a break. It's a crack, and that has been an objective that the U.S. has sought for some time, namely a stronger RMB so that it more accurately reflects the value of the currency in world trade. And I think that could happen, but it will not be anything that you have a communique about. The Chinese will do it in their own way, and there will be backroom talks about that.
Dan Sutherland, finally to you with Radio Free Asia. What about the concern of the administration balancing China's power and American power in the world? It now appears to be the second most influential nation that there is on the globe. Is that a principal goal, do you think, of the president?
I would say it's a goal, and it's been pretty well spelled out in some of the pre-trip briefings that this would be a goal. The ex-prime minister of Singapore was here recently and said that the U.S. really has let Chinese influence go too far and that the U.S. is needed to counterbalance the Chinese. So I think everybody kind of understands that that's in the background of this whole issue. I mean, the big sort of elephant in the room is this growing Chinese influence. Much greater economic clout, and as Michael Hirsch has written, we don't have a lot of clout to go in with. So this is definitely in the background, maybe not something they can sort of openly discuss with the Chinese.
So, Michael Hirsch, finally back to you. We began with you. It appears that there are a lot of issues, but that there's not going to be any kind of major announcement or a change of policy on anybody's part. This is kind of a get acquainted session, would you call it, with the President of the United States?
It's get acquainted and be strategically reassured, and let's hope to keep the status quo, as grim as it sometimes might be, particularly on the economic front, at least, you know, as good as it is, and not let it get any worse in terms of relations.
So you're not looking then for much in the way of substance. Would you look for important symbolic actions by the president that might tell us even more than his speech does about his administration and how it operates?
Well, you know, all eyes are going to be on the meetings in China with President and President Hu Jintao of China when they step out afterwards. What is said, what he says at this town hall meeting, how forthright he is, for example, on human rights issues, whether it's within China dealing with Tibet or the Uyghurs, or whether it's the broader question of political freedom in China, that will really determine the success or failure and what is most noted about this trip.
All right, Michael Hirsch, a senior editor at Newsweek magazine, author of At War With Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. Nicholas Cecchini, deputy director at the Japan Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Gary Hufbauer, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. His book, most recent book, Global Warming and the World Trading System. And Dan Sutherland, executive editor of Radio Free Asia, funded by Congress to broadcast news into countries that restrict the free press. That includes China, Burma, and North Korea, all countries we've talked about today. Thank you all very much for being with us. Chimpanzees are the closest relatives to humankind. They can even speak a crude kind of language. Now, researchers have discovered genetic clues, though, that explain how humans can do what no other animal can. More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Genes in human beings and chimpanzees have been compared to see why we have the ability to speak and they don't. It's all about a specific gene called FOXP2. Nicholas Wade reports the story in today's New York Times. And Nicholas, thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
First, it's my understanding that chimpanzees do use a kind of crude grunting to talk to each other about food. But that's, I take it, entirely different from human speech and the use of language by human beings.
Yes, it is, because they have words, as it were, for specific things. They have various noises that they make to indicate one thing or another, but the key to language is being able to string together words to form a meaningful sentence. And despite years of trying, researchers have never managed to get chimpanzees to do that, to link several sounds or symbols together in what you could call syntax.
Well, now it appears this has to do with the FOXP2 gene. Do both humans and chimpanzees have that gene?
Yes, they do. But what's so interesting is that the human version of the gene is different in just two of the 750 units in the gene. And these two units show signs of having been under very recent selective pressure, meaning that In the 5 million years since we and chimps diverged from our common ancestor, evolution has tweaked this gene in two places while leaving the chimp version of the gene unaltered.
And the result has been that human beings can speak and chimpanzees can't.
Well, it seems to be, and it's probably not the whole answer. There are probably lots of other genes involved we don't know about, but FOXP2 certainly seems to be a very major player. It first came to light in a large London family, half of whose members have a mutated form of the gene, and they also show a very interesting speech defects. They have trouble in sort of moving their lips in a fluent way so as to articulate fluent spoken speech, and they also have difficulties in comprehending language. So linguists insist that language and speech are sort of different because language can also come out in the form of sign language as well as spoken language, but nonetheless this gene seems to straddle the two faculties.
But it's the deficiencies in this human family that's been important to this research.
Yes, that's where it all began. It was about 5-7 years ago now that the family was identified, and molecular biologists found out very specifically it was this gene that was mutated. And it seems to be very active in embryonic development and the way the brain is wired up. So if you don't get the brain wired up in the right way, you just don't have the language faculty down very well.
When you were talking with our producer, Gary Scott, earlier today, you said this is a sort of royal roadmap into the mind. What do you mean by that?
Well, the chief, very important difference between us and chimps is that we have language and they don't, and probably lots of other aspects of our mind spring from the faculty of language. So if you're asking, well, what is the distinctive human difference with chimps, and what is it that makes us human rather than animals, you probably would want to start with language and with this particular gene. So it's of great interest to know exactly what this gene does. Now, since language is such a complicated faculty, it's not surprising that researchers today have found out that there's a whole network of genes controlled by FOXP2. And the next task is to try and understand what each of these genes does. And we have names for them because we've seen them in decoding the human genome. But for the most part, we've got no idea what their function is.
This gets enormously complex. You say that there are 750 units within the FOXP2 gene. Obviously, that allows for an enormous number of variations, particularly if you consider that other genes vary as well. What is the nature of the research into this? Are they visible? Are they mapped out on computers? How do scientists see what they do?
Oh, well, they have the sequence of the DNA, you know, which is about 3 billion units for each species. So most mammals have 3 billion units in their DNA. So this is it's a mind-boggling array of the four letters. So the human mind can't cope with it. You have to do it by computer. Mm-hmm. So they have all these sequences in a computer, and they can compare them. And then the DNA makes the protein. So the FOXP2 gene makes a pretty large FOXP2 protein, and it's the protein that has the 720 units, just two of which are different in the human version, whereas all other mammals, that's chimps and mice and all the other mammals whose FOXP2 genes we've sequenced, they all have a sort of pretty standard sequence, because it's such an important gene that nature seems to have kept it very conserved throughout evolution. So that's why it's sort of so interesting that in humans, just these two changes are made. Now we still don't really know what these changes do. We don't know how they affect the function of FOXP2, but we know that the FOXP2 protein's major role is to control other genes. So it sort of sits on the sites that activate or repress other genes, and a lot depends on how it sort of finds these sites and binds to them. And it may be these two extra genes sort of modulate its binding sites. So it's more like the conductor of an orchestra, because it's got these two different units. It somehow sort of conducts these genes, you know, making some more active and some less active in a different way that the chimp version of FOXP2 does. And that was the essence of the finding reported today, that if you put the chimp version of FOXP2 into human nerve cells grown in a lab dish, their genes sort of switch on and off in a very different pattern to the way they do when the human FOXP2 gene is there.
You said earlier that these two units apparently developed this capacity recently, 5 million years ago. What's a long time in this context?
Well, in evolutionary time, 5 million years is pretty recent. So that's the time when we and chimps last shared a common ancestor. And modern humans like ourselves, we first appear in the fossil record only sort of 200,000 years ago. So we're a very young species, and our evolution seems to have gone particularly fast.
Would it appear that Neanderthals had this capacity that they could speak to?
Oh, well, that's a fascinating question, and the jury's still out on that. Just recently, a guy in Germany, Santi Pabo, pulled off the spectacular feat of decoding the entire Neanderthal genome from DNA he'd retrieved from fossil bones. And just about the first thing he did was to look at the Neanderthal version of FOXP2. Now, the first reports were that it was similar to the human version.
Quickly, we're almost out of time.
But critics raised the question that his samples might have been contaminated by human FOXP2. Uh-huh. So we don't know the answer yet.
Okay. Thank you very much. Nicholas Wade, science reporter of the New York Times, The Faith Instinct About the Evolution of Religious Behavior, his most recent book. Join us again. I'm Warman Alney. To the Point is produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.